If you've scrolled social media recently, you've probably noticed a friend or a colleague or your friend or colleague's mum posting photos of themselves from some exotic and far-flung location. And what stands out? They're gloriously alone. One US tourism market research firm, Future Partners, has found nearly 40% of female travellers were interested in taking a solo trip in 2025. That's up 8% from that number in the previous year. And more travel companies are offering solo trips for women. It seems that the attitude of a growing number of women is, why wait any longer to embrace that big adventure? Elia Navarro describes herself as a solo backpacker and happy little traveller. Elia, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So your line sounds a bit patchy because you're travelling right now. Where are you?
I am very on brand for this story. I'm currently in a little fishing village in Bali called Ahmed. And if you hear any roosters and stuff in the background, that's why.
So talk to me about what are you seeing at the moment where you are?
Well, I'm huddled up where the Wi-Fi is best at the reception. But if I look up, the sun is rising and it's a beautiful day by the ocean. So, yeah, it'll be a nice day to enjoy the tropical island vibes here.
Yeah, I'm a bit jealous. So tell me, like, your travel street cred is pretty impressive. How many countries have you been to and where have you been by yourself?
So I've been to 47 countries so far, and a lot of them I've been to more than once. And so many, almost all of them I have kind of been to by myself at some point. But I'd say my best like street cred flexes are the really long trips I've done by myself, mostly through Europe for like 4 months at a time. And I think that they've definitely given me the biggest rewards in terms of, you know, learning how to be a good solo traveler, because there's some things you need to learn the hard way sometimes.
Okay, what sort of things?
I think just, you know, having confidence in yourself, having confidence to go up and say hello to strangers, and not having anyone to rely on when things start to go wrong, and having to, you know, get good at problem solving. And I started solo traveling when I was 19, so I barely had those skills at home, let alone on the road. So it was a bit of a baptism by fire, but it was the best way to do it and the most fun way for sure.
19 is definitely the age that I think a lot of people are traveling with mates. Why did you decide to strike out on your own?
Actually, I just couldn't find anyone that wanted to go at the time. And I felt like if I didn't go, then I would just kind of never go. So I think it's a really good lesson for anyone who wants to get into solo traveling, is that you can't, if you wait around for someone else to give you permission or to accompany you, you just might never do it, because time passes and people get busy and things change. So if you want to do it, just do it by yourself. It's really not that scary, and you'll find people already there doing it.
So tell me what the most important lesson is that you've learned, so that none of us have to learn it the hard way.
Probably I'd say just honestly saying hello to strangers and just assuming that everyone's kind of a friend you haven't met yet, because usually on the other side of the scary hello is like some of the best relationships and days you'll have on the road. So get over yourself and just go up and say hello, because you never know what kind of adventures that might lead to. And especially as a solo traveler, you're so flexible to just kind of pick up on other people's plans and change your plans and stuff. So it usually leads to some really good times. And I'm actually traveling right now with a friend I met on my very first trip in Japan when I was 19, and she's from France, and we've met all these years later. So it's a beautiful thing that can come out of these solo backpacking relationships you make.
I love that so much. How gorgeous. Had you seen each other in the intervening years?
We kind of met, even stayed in Paris for quite a few weeks, seeing her baby when she had her baby, and we've got her little three-year-old here now with us and her mum. So yeah, it's a beautiful kind of family affair now from these like cross-country relationships. It's really sweet.
Across the countries and across the years. Elia, we'd better let you get back to the sunrise and the roosters and your French mate. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Solo traveller extraordinaire Elia Navarro there. We're talking about embracing big adventures solo. Jane says, I've travelled solo for most of my life, over 50 years. First time, just turned 19 in 1973. I just can't wait for other people to get it together, but I meet others along the way. Now 70 and still travelling. Jane, you're my hero. So I want to get a sense of the big picture when it comes to women and solo travel. Catherine Koo is a professor of business and hospitality at Torrens University, and her research focuses on women travellers. Catherine, welcome. So we're seeing more and more women hit the road by themselves. What's behind this upward trajectory?
Right. There are so many different reasons. One is this changing attitude around marriage and family. And then, you know, women want to travel to challenge themselves. And there's so many stories like that on social media now that encourages each one of us to do that, you know, so people find courage when they didn't have it before. So that kind of propels this. And then post-COVID, you know, people want to do travel. And like Aliyah's case, in our research, we actually found that, yeah, people travel solo because they cannot find anyone else to travel with. So it, like, her story kind of confirms the findings that we have.
The word that she used when she was describing her reasons was not waiting for permission. And I feel like that is, yes, obviously men travel solo as well. And we will talk about that. But that feels like a very female thing to say.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's so many discourse on how we do womanhood, right? Like how we are always the provider to so many different people in different aspects of our life, the roles we play as daughter, mother, and then, you know, in-law, friend, colleague, and even at work, we are the nurturer, right? We're always something, a role to someone. And being on the road, you lose all of that. You're just living life for yourself. You don't have to take care of anyone else. And that's one of the things that our participants told us in our study too.
So you mentioned COVID as people wanting to get back out again. What about the role of social media, where you're just like, people only post their really great travel photos, so it really feels like everyone is traveling all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people like Aliyah, like she says, you know, she travels she's on the road at extended period of time. And we just published a paper on solo female van lifers, who are people who travel in prolonged mobility. And that's a different, you know, story altogether. But yeah, people, not everyone travel all the time. Sometimes people do take the plunge and do, you know, 1 week of solo travel, or just maybe 2 days of solo travel.
So why did you decide to focus on women in your research, Catherine? Because obviously everyone's traveling. Why women for you?
Okay, so obvious reasons. I am a woman and I have a restless spirit. I travel a lot on my own, and I had so many questions and I was undergoing so many different constraints, and I wanted to research this and see what is the extent of this surface level thoughts that I have. And then the research has got bigger and bigger, and it's been a 15-year journey since.
So that's your area of expertise, but mm-hmm. you are in this industry, you are looking at travel patterns. When we're saying that we're seeing upticks in women interested in traveling solo, are we seeing similar travel patterns in men?
So men have always been more likely to travel solo, but the percentage of women wanting to travel solo or are traveling solo are increasing at a bigger rate than the increase in men, if that makes sense.
Is that because men were always doing it solo before, or are they less likely?
Because travel was it was created by men, right? Like travel was, men were the geographers, the conquerors, they were the ones who were traveling, and women were the, you know, taking care of home, and then they started traveling. But we didn't have these stories of women traveling, or, you know, there were a lot of barriers to stop the stories of women who are traveling, to put them in their place.
We are talking about women embracing big adventures and men solo on Radio National Life Matters this morning. I'm Tegan Taylor, and I was thinking when you were speaking before, Catherine, about that idea of the grand tour, that UK gentry men would sometimes do that. Like young men, they finish school, maybe they finish university, and they go off and have a tour. This idea of striking out and being an adventurer wasn't confined to, you know, like people climbing Mount Everest, but was also something that was sort of a rite of passage for young men. But you're saying that that really wasn't part of the story for young women until quite recently.
Yeah, I mean, it was there. Women were traveling, but the stories of them traveling just were not made visible. And women have, like, we published a book on women in Victoria times who travel, and that's where we uncovered all of these stories of empowerment, emancipation, you know. And most of the time, these women, they travel during significant life transitions, whether it's, you know, graduation, death of a spouse, or, yeah, things like that.
Steve has called in. You know a solo woman traveller, Steve?
Yes. My wife, roughly in sort of early mid-40s, my wife got interested in ecotourism some years ago. When she had a long service leave being a teacher, she went across to Kenya for 2 to 3 months and taught in a Maasai village there, volunteer taught in a Maasai village for about 2 months at the time she was gone. So that involved living in the Maasai village, I think in like a tin hut, eating what they ate and then walking 10K each day to the school and back to teach and basically lived with them for the 2 months.
Did you have much contact with her? Did you have much contact with her while she was away?
Not much. Occasionally a phone call when she could. There was a period where she got particularly sick. She'd had all the vaccinations, but she picked up can't remember what it was, something similar to hepatitis from eating contaminated veggies. And I hadn't heard from her for a week or so, and apparently she's sort of been in hospital, but luckily there are a couple of other female travellers with her who happened to be nurses and they looked after her during that time. It was a tremendous experience for her, something that she wanted to do.
When she came back, was she different or was she, you know, was she excited? What did she sort of talk about reflecting on that experience?
I suppose, yeah, she certainly was excited. I suppose just living with the Maasai and how they lived, their difficulties, like seeing these young kids, like the 5 or 6 year olds, they'll go outside with a herd of cows outside the protected compound area during the days so their animals can graze, and all they've got is like a 600ml bottle of water, and they're out there all day during daylight hours tending the cattle in the midst of lions and sort of other animals as well. So, and the other thing that struck her was how much the kids wanted to learn, because it's secondary school there, they have to pay for their education, so they might go to a couple of school for a couple of years, and then they might have to go and work for a number of years, and then they might sort of come back and do another year, like 2 or 3 or 4 years later on, once they've got the money again. So there was quite a wide range of ages at the school where she was teaching. So
it sounds like such an eye-opening experience. Steve, thanks so much for calling.
No worries at all.
And Joanne, you've also been a solo traveller basically your whole life.
My whole life, I'm a solo. I exist solo, but I enjoy it. And just your last caller just reminded me that my first trip was backpacking through Indonesia in 1976 when I was 17, turning 18, and I called my parents once from the Denpasar post office on Christmas Day, and so the entire 3 months. And I just reflect now, my poor mother. My poor mother, she had no idea where I was. But then, yeah, fast forward to now, I just did 6 weeks in America on my own. I drove in Manhattan, actually drove a rental car, had to return it to Hertz in Midtown Manhattan. Tell you what, that's probably something I won't do again. That was a pretty frightening experience. But all I've really got to say out of all of my experiences, it is incredibly liberating for a woman to be able to travel on her own. It is one of the most liberating and enjoyable experiences.
What did that mean for you in real terms, Joanne?
Well, it's freedom, basically. It's freedom to go where you'd like to go, choose what you'd like to do, and whether you'd like to spend more time or less time in a particular location. There's a lot more flexibility. And also, traveling solo, I think you're more open to meeting more people and becoming involved in more different experiences because you're on your own, because people tend to view, I think, couples as doing their own thing, and couples tend to travel as couples, I suppose, or more in groups. But when you're on your own, you're open, I think. You're more open, and that's part of the liberation.
Joanne, thanks so much for sharing. Catherine Koo, I can see you nodding furiously when these people are telling their stories. It obviously is very much vibing with what you found in your research.
That's right. And also, you know, when Joanne was talking, I see the faces of all my past participants. And when I was there in the room to hear them tell their stories, you know, it's so heartening. It's just, yeah, I was even tearing a bit when Joanne was talking about Denpasar and, you know, her poor mother. Yeah.
Yeah, the experience of travel and being able to keep in touch is very different now to the way it was back in the 70s. And as we're sort of hearing, solo adventures have no age limit. On Radio National Life Matters, we're talking about women and men embracing big adventures solo. Margaret Yates's PhD is very much focusing on women travellers with a focus on solo women over the age of 60. Margaret, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So you've interviewed 29 women, and most of them are solo travellers, specifically road tripping in Australia. What's a typical participant like?
Well, of the 29 women, as you said, most of them were over 60, not by design, but just it was just the way that the study happened. What my whole plan was to find out who these women were, why they travelled, and importantly, what they did about their health, because I'm a registered nurse. What about they did about their health whilst they're out in the middle of nowhere? So, but in order to answer the health question, I had to understand who they were in the first place. So the findings from my research are, the first one was, as your previous speakers were just talking about, was the sense of freedom and liberation and being able to do what they wanted, when they wanted, without having to account for anybody else. And, yeah, that was probably the biggest finding. Then they talked about their sense of adventure. They were out there having a whole lot of fun, finding it exciting to travel across Australia and do new things, explore new places, meet new people. So they were just having a ball. They talked to me about their sense of safety. They consider that the lifestyle, being on the road, is very safe. None of my participants had any problems with any sort of untoward episodes by, you know, individuals or people that might harass them. And their health, a lot of them had, because of the age group, had chronic illnesses, but they didn't consider they thought they were pretty healthy, really. And their lifestyle, they think, actually improved their health because it's less stressful. There's less, you know, less of everything apart from the enjoyment of being on the road.
It does sound overwhelmingly positive. Were there downsides, or did they face opposition from family members?
Yeah, one participant talked about her family saying, "Oh no, you can't do that. You can't get out there on your own, and you'll never cope." When in fact, that probably motivated her more to do it. She had two daughters also that actually supported her, but the rest of her family weren't that keen. She's now been on the road more than 10 years. I spoke to her just a few days ago, actually, and she said, "Oh, still loving it, going to do it till she dies, just absolutely loves it." So she wasn't put off by the opposition.
Such interesting research, Margaret, and really sort of borne out with this text from Jessica. She's 61. She said, I started travelling solo in my 50s due to change in circumstances, but my confidence grew significantly with Facebook groups for over 50s travelling solo. They offered a lot of support and encouragement. Jessica finishes, it's been life-changing. And so there are that sort of support groups around to sort of help people. Jennifer, You were solo travelling quite a while ago. You travelled by ship 67 years ago.
It was 57 years ago.
Only 57 years ago.
I'm 80 now, but very few people flew then. It was too expensive. So the ships leaving Sydney were loaded with young Australian women all going on working holidays to Europe. So I was one of those, and I would have liked to have gone with someone else at the time, but a lot of my friends were now getting married and having children and whatnot, so no one wanted to go. And it was an adventure of a lifetime. I was away from home for 2 months less than 3 years, and there was no communication with home at that time. It was only aerogram letters in the mail. There were no mobile phones. My parents didn't even have a phone then in the house. So we were all in the same situation. And you looked forward to letters from home or cards, birthday cards and whatnot. But I remember I had my 25th birthday in London, and no cards arrived for my birthday because it was a mail strike in Sydney. And a week later, about 20 cards arrived. And the postman said to me, "There are a lot of cards for you today. What was it for?" And I said, "Well, it was my birthday a week ago."
Oh my gosh, Jennifer. It just baffles me how much our lives and society have changed in the space of a lifetime.
Exactly. We didn't have credit cards, so I took traveller's checks. But I worked in London and I worked in Rome. I worked in Rome for nearly 8 months and stayed another 3 months in Rome because I'd made friends. But I loved travelling on my own. I made some nice friends. I met the locals. And it was wonderful.
That's beautiful. Jennifer, thanks so much for sharing. I hope there's still some more trips in your future.
Chris, I'm still travelling, but I'm travelling with my husband now.
Well, there you go. That's nice. A companion for the journey. Christine, you started travelling solo more along the lines of Margaret Yates's work when you were in your late 60s.
Yes, yes.
Where'd you go?
I did. So it was during the first and second years of COVID, and I'd always been interested in caravanning, and my husband started out with me and didn't enjoy it as much as I did, and I just decided, I think I can do this, and I had a go, and I drove a caravan on two big trips around New South Wales, confined to New South Wales, and then the next trip I could get across the Queensland border, and I did some travelling in southeast Queensland and came home, and it was a terrific experience. And what I have learned is women don't be fooled. It is just skill. Managing a caravan by yourself, driving, reversing, parking, map reading, they're just skills. You don't need heaps of strength. Balanced with that, of course, is the kindness of strangers everywhere you go in caravan parks. And I returned the kindness. I returned it forward. So when I was a novice, I needed a little bit of help on the odd occasion. But then I realised I was becoming one of the old hands.
That's such a good feeling to be able to be an old hand and show someone how it's done. Christine, thank you so much for the call.
Okay, thank you, Tina. Bye-bye.
Bye. And John has a story about travelling solo. John, I apologise already. We talked a lot about women in the story so far, but you've got a story too.
I do. And rightly so, you've been talking about women. I took up hiking the Heisen Trail solo. I'm about 700 kilometres up a 1,200-kilometre trail, and I could have found a mate or somebody to walk it with, but I decided I was going to take on the extra challenge and do it, and I've taken every step of it on my own. And I can tell you that it's been an amazing experience. I've really, really – because you've got no one to talk to, no one to chat to, you – go deep, deep inside your head. You've got nothing else to do but walk and think for 8-10 hours a day. and things come into your head you haven't thought about for many, many years. And it really built my sense of confidence and a real sense of self-achievement. And interestingly, in all of my trails, I've run into many other solo hikers. I have never run into another man who's solo hiking. It's always women.
Is that right?
That is so true. And that could be young, that could be old, middle-aged, every age. But women, I don't know, it seems to appeal to them more, perhaps. But far, far more often I run into women on the trail with a hiking solo, and not a man yet. But I remember that very first walk I did, which was a real test for me because I hadn't done anything like it before. I walked 5 days from the head of the trail to a place called Victor Harbour. So I basically walked into the bush for 5 days with everything on my back, including food, mattress, everything, inflatable mattress, all on my back. And when I walked into it hardly stopped raining for about 3 or 4 days. But when I walked into Victor Harbour, I walked up to my car and I had the emotion just overwhelmed me and I just bawled my eyes out. And I don't know what it was, relief, it was exhaustion, mental and physical. And I was just so proud of myself, and it changed me as a person for the better. And I recommend it to anybody. Just get out there, get walking, get out in the bush, buy some cheap, nasty gear if you don't know how to get into it, because you can go into one of these big brand hiking places and spend thousands. Don't do it. Just buy some cheap, nasty stuff to get you going. But just get out on the trail, get out amongst nature, go into your head and just enjoy it for what it is. You know, it's an amazing pastime. I'm glad I stumbled across it.
So did you say you're 700 k's into the 1200? Are you on the trail at the moment?
No, unfortunately I have to pay tax for a living, so I've had to break it up into sections and I achieve it that way. There, I did run into some through, what you call a through hiker, which is someone who's doing the whole trail in one go. The only person I've struck who's doing that was, again, a young lady, probably in her early 20s, and she expected her to take her about 80-odd days without a break, just walking sort of 8 to 10 hours a day. I think she might have been raising money for charity or something at the time. But, yeah, they're all the intrepid people out there doing this, they're women.
That's whatever incredible. Reason. John, thank you so much for sharing your story. And one quick final chat with Greg, you did a big long walk while you were doing your PhD.
No, not a walk. This was about the maggots.
Oh, right. Tell me quickly.
Well, essentially, when I was a PhD student, we organised a conference in the Barossa Valley, and one of the mini symposia that we had was on forensic entomology versus conventional forensic science. And so the thing that really I remember mostly is seeing a film that was done by one of the master's students when she was looking at pigs and the strike of the pigs with the various blowflies and whatnot. And it was time lapse. So you saw the pig blow up and then deflate, and the maggots on the eyes and all the soft parts, and it was just gruesome. It really was. But you didn't have the smell. There's no odorama.
The benefit of watching that on video instead of in real life. Greg, thanks so much for the visual.
Yeah. But she did it in a back shed down at Semaphore in Adelaide.
Can't imagine her neighbours were very impressed.
I'm not sure how the neighbours coped with it, but anyway, it was just quite amazing.
Greg, thank you so much for the call. So, Catherine Koo, in terms of your research, I saw you nodding when we heard, I think it was Jennifer, talking about travelling abroad as a young woman 50, 60 years ago. It's obviously not that much of a new trend.
No. Yeah, this was the one I was talking to you about at the start, where we were polling, retrieving stories of women going overseas on big ships. And the experiences are not much, you know, like the logistical things like communication are very different, but actually the stories of emancipation and empowerment are not much different, actually. So,
Thank you, Margaret Yates. Margaret is a PhD candidate from the University of Technology, Sydney, who's researching women travellers. And thank you to Catherine Koo, Professor of Business and Hospitality at Torrens University. You also heard from solo travel Elia Navarro, who called us from Bali.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.